Good morning, hello, and welcome all to our Denton Perspective, which is going to be a daily briefing from the Republican and Democratic conventions, which we are thrilled to be able to offer to our friends around the globe. We'll be discussing the stories and policies behind the headlines each day with those who understand them best. I'm Kathleen O'Connor, a member of the Denton's Public Policy and Regulation Practice, and I'll be the moderator for today's program. As many of you know, Denton's is the world's largest law firm, with 7,500 lawyers in 56 countries. Because we're uniquely connected to those communities in which we have presences, we provide our clients a competitive edge through our knowledge of local cultures in navigating business disputes or challenges. It's our hope that clients, friends, and the media will benefit from these briefings as we draw on the deep knowledge and experience of our public policy team. Just for some media information, everything said on today's call may be treated as an on-the-record comment. While our program today does not allow for questions from our audience, members of the media may reach out to the Denton's communication contacts in your region to follow up with our speakers. Everyone listening can find out more about the topics we discussed today by following us on Twitter at Denton's. Our program today includes a discussion with former Speaker of the House of Representatives and Republican presidential candidate Newt Gingrich and former Vermont Governor and Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean. Both are members of the Denton's public policy practice and have more experience than perhaps anyone else today at navigating the politics of presidential conventions. So thank you, Governor Dean, and thank you, Speaker Gingrich, for joining us this morning. With that, I'll begin, and Speaker Gingrich, I think we'll begin with you with our first question. And I know you are joining us from Cleveland, and again, we appreciate your time. Republicans, like Democrats, are on the eve of nominating, at least according to the polls, the least popular general election candidate in the history of their party. And yet Mr. Trump has been the most successful Republican primary candidate in history. So how does Mr. Trump leverage this convention, the enthusiasm of transitioning from a divisive primary to the general election, the news that he selected Governor Pence as his vice presidential pick, to overcome his polling popularity deficit with the voters?
Well, I think that those are great questions. I mean, first he has to bring forward a more complete sense of who he is. And I've looked at the speeches that Ivanka and Don Jr. and Eric are going to give, and they're very personal, and I think will be very effective. I also think there'll be people from the Trump organization talking about various things that he has accomplished over the years, and I think that's also going to be helpful. So to some extent, they will soften who he is, and I think his acceptance speech will lead us towards a more positive vision of America's future. I also think that Mike Pence was a very good choice from the standpoint of uniting the Republican Party. And I think that for a lot of Republicans who had been a little uncertain about Trump and a little put off by Trump's style and his aggressiveness, I think they see Pence as reassurance that there's somebody on the ticket they can reach out to and talk to and have a good relationship with. And I think that's already begun to pay dividends with various Republicans who are more comfortable now that you have a Trump-Pence ticket.
For that. And I'll turn to Governor Dean with my next question, which is, what do you think the general election looks like with two unpopular candidates whose unfavorables have never been higher? Do you have any thoughts or comments on that, Governor Dean?
Yeah, I mean, I think both candidates are likely to get a bump out of their conventions, although that's sort of the conventional wisdom, and there's nothing about this election that has anything to do with conventional wisdom, so who really knows? I think at the end of the day, Hillary's going to win, and I think she's going to win because Trump's too scary. People are going to look at him and just say, can this guy really be president of the United States? And the answer is going to be no for a lot of people who are on the fence. On the other hand, there were a bunch of polls out this morning where Hillary had 3 or 4 point leads, and they were all polls of registered voters. That is not a good polling technique. I think the only people who have fared worse than all the people that Trump beat in this election were the pollsters who really have made the kinds of mistakes that I've never seen in politics before. Every single one of them, for example, underestimated Donald Trump as he's going down the path to victory. Every single one of them missed Michigan on the Democratic side. So this is a very, very confusing election. At the end of the day, I think you have to be able to be seen as president. I think Donald Trump is a long way from being able to be seen as president.
Speaker Gingrich, do you want to react to that at all?
As you might imagine, Howard and I have slightly different visions of the fall campaign, which is part of what makes our partnership fun. I would say a lot of what Howard just said is true. Trump has to, by giving a series of set piece speeches, by reacting as he did to Dallas and to Baton Rouge, where he was more statesmanlike, quieter, I think he's got to communicate a sense that people can look at him and say, yeah, I can imagine him as president. Because if you can't imagine him in the Oval Office, you can't in the end vote for him. And I think that's a factor that's very real. The other part of that, though, is that, and maybe I'm overdoing this just because, like Howard, I was surprised by how often conventional wisdom failed. And since it was in my own party, I felt doubly run over because I couldn't have imagined if you talked to me in January 2015 that you'd have Donald Trump beat 16 other people and do so while spending less than some of them. I mean, it isn't that Trump as a billionaire went out and bought the nomination. Trump went out with a very strong message and a remarkable use of social media and actually won the nomination with the largest Republican vote in history while spending, I think, one-fourth the amount that Jeb Bush did. I mean, a remarkable achievement. And part of what you're seeing right now is Hillary last month spent $20 million in attack ads. Trump spent zero. And a lot of the polling data you're getting reflects the fact that in an uncompetitive environment where the only ads are Hillary's, she's able to temporarily push down on Trump, but she's not particularly helping herself. I mean, the Comey's explanation of her guilt by itself on was more devastating than any Trump ad could have been. And so I think you've got a situation where when Trump turns the general election and they look at what they've got to get done, all the evidence here so far is he's pretty effective at figuring out how to send messages that get him votes, including, for example, in Nevada where he carried the Latino vote. I mean, I think there's a lot of things moving around that I frankly don't fully understand.
If I could just add one thing to this. What's going on in the United States is going on all over the globe. There's an absolute relationship between Brexit, the Brexit vote, and the vote for Donald Trump. And this is not just England, it's Europe, and it's also in authoritarian countries. I think we're divided in this world into two camps, those who have benefited by globalization and those who have not. There are a lot of people who have been left behind by globalization. And it's not so much the trade deals, although that's what gets the blame. It's the evolution of an internet-dependent economy. There's a lot of places, including the United States, where our education system and our retraining system has not kept up with these extraordinary, very, very rapid, both economic and social changes. That, I think, is why this election is so unpredictable. We haven't seen one like this before because we've never had the kind of acceleration of change that we've had in the last 15 or 20 years.
Let me just say, I
agree entirely with what Howard just said. And I really do think you've got to look at Austria, the Italian city elections, Brexit, and the Iceland presidential election, and then the impeachment of the Brazilian president. To get this flavor of how really changed worldwide is a phenomenon that has to be seen as more than just the U.S.
Agreed. And with that, let me ask you both. There are nearly 1,600 American troops stationed on American military bases located within Turkey. How will the internal volatility of Turkey affect not only the geopolitics in that region, but its relationship with NATO in general, and America in particular? I don't know which one of you wants to take that.
Well, I'll start. I mean, we both have spent a lot of time on this kind of stuff. In my own view, you know, President Erdogan has been moving, as we know, over the last 4 or 5 years to be much more of an authoritarian figure. You know, who knows how this all happened and what the inside was. But we do know and we can see that President Erdogan is using this as an excuse to purge people who had nothing to do with a coup. The idea that 3,000 judges somehow had something to do with a coup is nonsense. They were on some list long before. So this is a real problem. Turkey has always been, for the last 50 years, an essential military ally. They're in one of the most geopolitically sensitive areas of the world, at the crossroads between the Middle East, Iran, Russia, and then Europe. It's an important nation no matter what kind of government they have and no matter how we like it or don't like it. I am worried about Turkey because I think they are moving very quickly away from being a democratic society. And I think that in the long run is not good for their economy, and it's not good for peace in the region, which has been pretty elusive over the last many decades.
I think Howard is basically right. Erdogan is more and more anti-American and anti-European. He is more and more an Islamist. He is using what are clearly unconstitutional techniques to consolidate power in an authoritarian dictatorship. He and his son have been very corrupt. And one of the reasons he had to win the last election is he probably would have gone to jail if he had lost the power of the presidency to protect himself. So it's a very unstable situation compounded by our weakness. And you really don't know. I mean, they do in the end fear the Russians. They do in the end have a real problem with the Kurds. It's not a risk-free game for Erdogan. And the odds are at least even money that the American air base at Incirlik will continue to be there. But it could become more risky. And, of course, he's now demanding that we deport or extradite to Turkey the cleric who has been the leading anti-Erdogan cleric in the world. And that cleric indicated this morning that if the U.S. wanted to extradite him, he'd go back to Turkey. So it's a very interesting phenomenon. And we'll see exactly how it plays out.
How do either or both of you think that this geopolitical unrest and Governor Dean referred to it earlier, how will this play out in the election campaign?
I don't think it will. I mean, to a certain extent, it advantages Hillary most likely slightly because she has obviously a lot of experience, which Trump doesn't have. On the other hand, it gives Trump the opportunity to talk tough and sound authoritarian, which always appeals to people no matter where they are when things are difficult. But, you know, people in this country generally don't vote on foreign policy unless we're in the middle of a war. And I don't think this election is going to be determined by what happens in foreign policy unless some, you know, horrible event happens on American soil. So, we don't usually vote on foreign policy in this country with the exception of a catastrophe. I think it gives a small edge to Hillary to have all that experience, and I'm sure she's going to use this to show that Trump, you can't be safe with Trump, and Trump will be doing the same on the opposite side with his more authoritarian approach.
No, I think it's a two-way street. I think, first of all, it depends on what happens in the next couple of months. If you have another series of events like Nice and Orlando, it is, I think, very much to Hillary's disadvantage. If it's a pure security issue or if it's a question of protecting cops, there's an enormous advantage for Trump psychologically and how the country organizes itself. On the other hand, if this is the peak moment and from here on it just sort of gradually goes away, then this will revert to being a domestic issues election. I don't think we know yet, although there's a fair amount of evidence, and I recommend everybody that they read Daniel Silva's novel, Black Widow, because it really gives you a vivid sense of what's happening in France and around the region. I think there's a fair amount of evidence that ISIS and its allies will make a major effort in the next 3 months to be very, very disruptive. And the French director of intelligence said a couple of days before the event in Nice that he is genuinely afraid that a civil war is going to break out across all of Europe. So, I mean, I do think that this is a very volatile environment.
Well, thank you for those and for your comments. And, you know, our thoughts, as I'm sure yours are too, are with the people in the Baton Rouge community today as it's grappling with the death of their law enforcement officers and with those who are injured and, you know, in life support, et cetera. You know, that incident came only after the tragic incident in Nice, where we lost 84 people. And media reports that, you know, the convention speakers today, with the exception, and maybe not with the exception of Mrs. Trump, will focus on the issues of national security. Set to that backdrop of these increasingly violent occasions, Speaker Gingrich, do you think that Trump can position himself as better suited to manage national security and defense, running opposite from Secretary Clinton, who served as America's top diplomat?
Well, I think there's no instance since 1964 in which a Democrat has been able to be a safety and security candidate in this kind of a crisis. I mean, it is enormously to the Democrats' advantage to have safety as a non-issue. And, of course, as you point out, we're now in this terrible environment where we both have terrorists motivated by Islamic supremacism on the one hand, such as Orlando or San Bernardino, and now we have a whole new wave of people deliberately going out to target policemen, which is a direct threat to the entire fabric of our civilization. I mean, if this continues very much, it will recreate the mood of the late 1960s, which ultimately led to Richard Nixon and then to Ronald Reagan.
Governor Dean, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think Newt is right. I think, you know, domestic instability leads towards the move voters towards to tend towards authoritarianism. And so I do think that's right. The only problem is that I don't think Trump is nearly as convincing as either Ronald Reagan or Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon may have been a crook, but he was a very, very smart guy. He was very well informed about world policy. That is not the case with Donald Trump. Reagan was initially thought to have been too conservative and a bit of a radical, but he'd been governor of the state of California for two terms and turned out to have a tremendous ability to connect with people, which I don't think Donald Trump has. So this is really an anger versus hope election in some ways. And in that scenario, hope usually triumphs. But again, this is a year where every rule that I can think of in electoral politics has been broken. So, you know, I do believe Hillary's going to win. But as I say to my Democratic friends, we're going to lose, have a lot of sleepless nights between now and then.
Right, exactly. And as we touched on earlier, accurately tracking voter sentiment on Donald Trump has been increasingly difficult for pollsters all around the country. Because Trump has repeatedly, though, outperformed expectations during the primary, Governor Dean, are you confident that the general election polls might be more accurate?
Absolutely not confident in any polls. I think, again, pollsters have looked bad, worse than either candidate so far in this election. It's just absolutely unbelievable. Their models have collapsed. Their inability to deal with cell phones has finally caught up with them. There are huge numbers of American households that have no hard lines anymore. So, of course, the sample I suspect hard lines are over sampled. I mean, you know, there's an enormous number of things that are wrong with the polling. So, I don't have any confidence whatsoever. The only thing I would say that it would be probably in the Democrats' favor, although you can't take this to the bank either because you don't know who's going to vote, is that the polling in a primary is a totally different science than it is in a general election. Even though Hillary got, 15 million votes and Trump got 13 million or something like that, that has no relationship to what may or may not happen during the general election. The natures of the primaries was very different. It is true that Trump had the biggest turnout ever in the Republican primary, but that doesn't mean anything because it's the Republican primary. It's a very small sampling, and so is the Democratic primaries relative to the number of people who are going to vote. I mean, I think probably close to 100 million people are going to vote, which is four times the number that voted in the Democratic and Republican primaries combined. So again, you're right. Nobody can predict, except that the polls are probably going to be wrong no matter what they say. And the second thing is, I don't think this is going to get better between now and Election Day, but I also don't think you can make any, other than the polls are bad and not likely to get better, I don't think you can make any predictions about what's going to happen on Election Day based on what happened in either primary.
Thank you for that. Speaker Gingrich, until only days ago, you were shortlisted for Mr. Trump's vice presidential pick. Having seen firsthand the vetting of the various candidates, what do you make of the Pence selection, and how do you think it will play in November?
Well, let me say, first of all, I think for our listeners, it was a very interesting process that I had never been through before. Their view was A.B. Culverhouse led the team that did it. He's done a number of these over the years. Their view is that the voters vet the nominee, but the vice presidential candidate is, by definition, not vetted by the voters, and so it has to be very aggressively vetted by some team. So we had, Chris and I had to fill out 113 questions, one of which was our taxes back through 2004. So the sheer volume of material we turned over was absurd. One of their questions to me was, would I list everything I had written? And I called and said, this is, of course, a joke. So I accepted if I listed 30 books, that would count without getting into articles, et cetera. But anyhow, they then came over to the office, and Cliff and I, along with Beth Kelly, who's our chief operating officer, we spent almost 3 hours going through things, answering questions, et cetera. And when I talked to Trump, I spent 2.5 hours with Donald last Thursday talking about all this stuff and reaching an agreement that Pence would actually be the best choice for this year because of the need to reunify the more timid Republicans. And in that process, he said that they did a really good job and that they walked him through, you know, the strengths, the weaknesses, the questions they had. And I said that I was confident, given the very large deals he'd done in his career, that he was pretty good at delegating to experts and then using their results. So I thought it was an impressive system. I'm kind of glad we went through that part of it. I think picking Pence is actually very, very healthy and useful. As we talked it through, and some of you heard me say this, you know, I said to Trump at one point, look, you can have a two-pirate ticket, because we're both kind of pirates. We're both big and noisy, and we both are willing to take on the establishment. I said, but you may want to, in fact, have somebody more stable. It may well be that for the country, and I think Howard would agree with this, one pirate and a normal person is a better ticket than two pirates. So I think in that sense, Pence has absolutely worked out as we hoped he would, and I think that for the more normal traditional Republicans, he's actually strengthened the ticket and made this week much easier than it would have been with a Trump-Gingrich ticket.
I would actually have some disagreements. I think they should have picked Newt, and because Newt has a much broader grasp of the issues. Pence is more conservative than the average Republican. He's very, very conservative. Especially, I mean, he's a no abortion under any circumstance. And then he went through this huge farce where he tried to make it okay for businesses to discriminate against gay and lesbian couples, which blew up in his face, and the business community threatened to leave Indiana, and some of them did. His numbers in Indiana called into question if he could get reelected, and actually with a popular former senator coming back on the ticket and Pence on the Republican ticket, I actually think we have a better shot in Indiana than we did before Pence was chosen. So I do believe that Pence is a sober mind. I agree with Newt's pirate analysis. But I don't think much is going to be heard of Pence, and I don't think that vice presidential candidates have made much of a difference since 1960 when Lyndon Johnson was an incredibly effective person to help John Kennedy get elected. But that's really the last time that's happened. So I think we would disagree. I would have picked Newt Gingrich.
Well, thank you for that.
By the way, Catherine, Catherine, now you know why Trump didn't pick me, because he thought the power team would have picked me.
Exactly.
Well done.
Exactly.
Well done.
That's great. That's great. Well, we only have a couple minutes left with our two esteemed colleagues. I'm wondering, Speaker Gingrich, can you, you know, talk to us a little bit about what's going to be happening today in Cleveland? And then my question will also be that, you know, in practical terms, this nomination is over, but the anti-Trump conservatives are still grumbling. And is there anything that could, in any reasonable universe, derail Trump's nomination this week?
No. Let me start with that first. I think Ken Cuccinelli is crazy. I think that the idea that you're going to take on a guy who carried 37 states, got the largest vote in history, has an entire nationwide operation, and other than causing trouble and being a nuisance, it really shrinks Cuccinelli from being a serious person to being just a gadfly. So I think that'll disappear. There'll be some noise. The media, as usual, will emphasize the noise because that's more fun. But the fact is, this is Trump's convention. They dominated the platform. They dominated the Rules Committee. Randy Evans, who was a part of Denton's, was a real leader in the rules fight, and Randy did a great job. They had absolute working control of the Rules Committee, which was the critical place, and they're going to have control of the floor, period. So I think that's over. Today's focus on national security and homeland security. Dallas and Baton Rouge make us pay a little more attention to safety at home as well as overseas. There's going to be a number of very good speakers. I think Giuliani is this afternoon, and I think that you're going to have a number of folks who are going to speak very elegantly, eloquently rather, about that. And I think that there's sort of an effort to have a theme a day. Calista and I are going to speak Wednesday night, and we're looking forward to it very, very much. And, of course, we're also looking forward to the reception which Denton's is hosting here. And I think you're going to host a similar reception in Philadelphia, which is a great opportunity both for Denton's partners and for clients to get together. And somebody told me we already had over 300 RSVPs to the event here.
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you. Thank you both for your time. Thank you both for your insight. We look forward to speaking with you over the course of these conventions. And we greatly appreciate you taking the time today. We know the first day of the convention is usually very busy, and we understand that you are both busy, so we appreciate you taking the time for all of our friends and clients around the world.
That's good.
Now, I know you'll be hearing each day this week from us for a first half hour from 9:30 to 10, speaking from the convention about issues of the day. But we'll also each day this week spend the final 15 minutes of our time together by devoting our conversation to a specific policy area related to the day's speeches. And so for today, we are being joined by retired Army General Tim Hake, who is a senior policy advisor at Denton, who will share his thoughts on the recent unrest in France and Turkey and how those events will help shape the national security debate here in the United States. So with that, I'm going to turn the floor and mic over to retired Army General Tim Hake.
Absolutely, and I will, after a slight diversion, I'll pick up where the previous speakers ended. Each day there's going to be a separate theme at the convention, and the theme for today is Make America Safe Again. So this is, of course, an opportunity for the Republican Party to make some points philosophically, to showcase up-and-comers and achieve other strategic advances. Let me go down, and I'll only hit a couple of two or three of the key speakers who are not household names, like Rudy Giuliani, for example. But the ones I want to talk about are in keeping with this motif. And basically, I think events are playing right into the hands of the speakers around the world and here at home. One will be Marcus Luttrell, who's a Navy SEAL. Those of you who saw the movie Lone Survivor know his story. Pat Smith, who's a mom of one of the people killed in Benghazi. David Clark, who's the sheriff of Milwaukee County, and I believe they had a police shooting there this morning. U.S. Senator Tom Cotton, he's a Army combat veteran, served in Iraq and Afghanistan, served one term in the House from Arkansas, and then became senator. He is on the Armed Services Committee and the Intel Committees, plus he's been there and done that. So I think his perspectives will be quite valuable, as will one of his colleagues, Joni Ernst. Joni Ernst visited during her campaign for the Senate in Iowa, visited every one of the 99 counties in Iowa on her Harley. She's the first female combat veteran to serve in the Senate, and she's a great person beside that. And then one other I'd like to mention is Ryan Zinke. Ryan is a former Navy SEAL, member of the House of Representatives from Montana, served 23 years, and the last part of that was in SEAL Team 6, which is the most elite of the teams. So I think you're going to get a perspective from all of these. I know when speaking with Senator Ernst that she's going to stress when she goes on foreign trips and meets with world leaders, they all ask her, what's going on in your country and why is America not stepping up and fulfilling its leadership role in the world? I think that will kind of be emblematic of what you will hear. And as I said before, world events are playing right into this strategy. Speaker Gingrich mentioned that he thinks the next few months are going to be even more chaotic than have the past few, and I would concur in that assessment. ISIS is indeed losing ground on the battle space, losing the ground war, losing some of its senior leaders, and having to spend more and more time and energy evading bombs. They have lost Fallujah to the Iraqi forces. There is a big battle shaping up for Mosul, and that'll take place when it's not quite so hot over there and the Iraqis and others are more capable of taking on that battle. But I think you'll hear a mantra of why are we letting people out of Guantanamo when we know that about a quarter of them return to the battlefield? Why are we not playing a more preemptive role in dealing with ISIS? And why are we half-stepping there? One thing I'd also say is that here at home, things are not good in terms of race relations, of course, and then that's spilling into violence on the streets and attacks on police officers. I think David Clark, as I said, is the sheriff of Milwaukee County, will have much to say about that. Because ISIS is on the run, I think they will then resort to more bloody terrorist attacks across the world. This is to some degree an effort to win hearts and minds and keep the foreign fighter flow alive. That is down because of many factors. But you'll see that since they're not being victorious on the battlefield, they are resorting to more to unconventional warfare, which explains the Nice attack. I think it's come out in the open source press that person who perpetrated that crime was radicalized. They have arrested, I think, seven people in Nice, and they have found a text that he sent talking to some of his friends that I need more guns and ammunition. The just to go a little bit further down in the weeds on that particular operation, if you look back to the Al-Qaeda online magazine, which is called Inspire, way back in 2010, they had a laundry list of things you can do where you are. You don't need to come and get training in Syria or in Afghanistan or any other location anymore. Here are some things, and one was exactly what we saw in Nice, that horrific attack in which three Americans were killed, one young child. So I think you will see more of that because they want to continue to monopolize the airways. And after all, this is terrorism. It doesn't have to be body count, but it does have to be dramatic. And even that same Inspire thing spoke about just using knives, and we've seen that in Israel, lots of stabbings. So we're in for, I think, a tough time up until the election, and this, to bring it back to the topic, plays into the strategy of the Republicans. They're going to try to tie Hillary Clinton to Obama, and Obama as being responsible for the international and domestic violence and disruption that we're seeing. So I think that's the game plan. We'll see how successful they are in November. But I'd be happy to entertain any questions or delve deeper into some of the things that I touched on initially.
Well, thank you very much, Major General, for your thoughts and particularly for outlining what we can anticipate hearing and seeing today during the course of the day. I think that we will conclude our call now, and we will look forward to talking to everybody same time, same place tomorrow. And until then, everyone enjoy a wonderful Monday. Thank you again, Major General.
Yes, thank you, Kathleen.